From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This month, Maryland became the first state in the country to bar high schools from automatically releasing student test scores on a widely used aptitude test, a test developed by the U.S. military to identify potential recruits. Many schools had been sending results, as well as detailed information about students, directly to recruiters without parents' permission. Now, sponsors of the ban in Maryland are pushing for a ban in other states, as NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Ross Garcia took the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, or ASVAB, back in high school in Laurel, Maryland. Boring, he remembers thinking. But towards the end of the 3.5-hour test, something piqued his interest.
I remember seeing Armored Assault Vehicle Commander, and that stuck in my brain for a long time.
Garcia had not thought that much about the military, but not long after taking the ASVAB, he started talking to his father about joining the Army.
And he was completely against it. He said if I joined the military, I would get shot.
Garcia joined ROTC after enrolling at the University of Maryland, where he's now a junior. After college, he hopes to serve in Iraq or Afghanistan. To this day, Garcia isn't sure he told his parents he had taken the ASVAB, but his school did turn over his test results to military recruiters. That was wrong, says Sheila Hickson, who chairs the House Ways and Means Committee in the Maryland legislature.
The parents have a right to know.
What Hickson did was push through legislation making Maryland the only state in the country that no longer allows schools to administer the ASVAB without parental approval. It also prevents schools from releasing the test results to military recruiters without parents' or students' permission.
We didn't criticize the test, didn't ask them to change anything. That is not our role. Our role was to let the parents know, and that's all.
With more than 600,000 high school students in Maryland and across the country taking the test every year, Hickson says she saw this as an issue of parental rights and students' privacy. But the man who oversees all active duty recruiting for the U.S. Department of Defense, Dr. Curtis Gilroy, says the U.S. military has nothing to do with how school officials administer the ASVAB or release the results.
Whether or not the school officials seek student or parent or guardian permission is entirely up to that school, and we don't have anything to say about that at all.
There's no doubt, though, says Gilroy, that the ASVAB is important to military recruiters because it's a treasure trove of information about students, their talents, and skills.
The ASVAB really is to the military what the SAT is to colleges and universities.
That's why he worries about what Maryland has done.
The Maryland law completely limits the release of scores, and it does create barriers to students to learn more about the opportunities and benefits of military service and careers. That is what is unfortunate about the Maryland law.
Critics say the ASVAB is a lot more than a career exploration test.
It is perhaps the military's most important recruiting tool, period.
Pat Elder is with the Maryland Coalition to Protect Student Privacy. It lobbied vigorously to stop schools from automatically releasing the ASVAB test results to recruiters.
They're able to give a test to 650,000 kids every year, and they do so largely without parental consent. I mean, 92% of the kids that took the test didn't have parental consent.
And even though the ASVAB is a voluntary test, Elder says over 1,000 schools require it. The Pentagon could not verify this or confirm if the 92% figure was accurate. The Maryland Coalition to Protect Student Privacy, meanwhile, is advising groups in Wisconsin, Oregon, New Hampshire, Georgia, North Carolina, and a few other states to require parents' permission before schools give kids the ASVAB or release the results. As for Ross Garcia, who credits the ASVAB for helping him consider a military career, he says he just wanted to serve his country.
And if a high school student truly wants to do it, he should be able to make that choice. He shouldn't have to have his father's permission.
Garcia says even his father couldn't keep him from falling in love with the military. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Joe Palca. Ira Flatow's away. Later in the hour, we'll be talking about silk and viruses in your genome. But first, research ethics. Like any field of human endeavor, there are people in science who break the rules. Maybe they leave out some contradictory data, or touch up an ambiguous picture to make it seem clearer, or plagiarize someone else's work. But for science, this is a special problem. There's no police squad to keep scientists honest, and sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between intentional wrongdoing and honest error. Well, some social scientists have taken a look at this problem, and they think they have some solutions to offer, and that's what we're going to talk about. So give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet us your questions by writing the @ followed by SciFry. And if you want more information about what we're talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now let me introduce my guest. Gerald Kuchar is a professor of psychology and associate provost at Simmons College in Boston. He's also the author of an opinion paper on this topic that appeared in last week's edition of the journal Nature. Welcome to the program, Dr. Kuchar.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. So I guess the first question is, is this a problem? I mean, is this a problem in is this a solution in search of a problem, or is there a problem here with research ethics?
Well, there's very real problem. I don't want to suggest that all of science by any means is contaminated, but we surveyed 2,600 biological, biomedical, and behavioral science researchers, and they told us about more than 3,000 incidents that they had run across in their career where someone was cheating or doing something that was likely to contaminate the research record.
So what does that mean? So does that mean that these are the people that responded to your survey, so maybe there's some, bias in who decided to respond, but are you saying that this is something that, at least at a low level, is occurring on a rather regular basis?
It occurs with some degree of regularity, and of course there are different levels of intensity or severity of the problem.
Uh-huh. So what's an example of the kind of thing? I mean, obviously, if someone makes data up from whole cloth, that's terrible. That's lying. But what are the kinds of things that we're talking about that sort of are in between that and something that that might be considered questionable?
The kinds of things that the federal government focuses on for federally funded research is mostly what's called FFNP, fabrication, which is making up data out of whole cloth, falsification, which is modifying your data to fit your needs, or plagiarism, passing off someone else's work as your own. But we are also concerned, for example, about questionable authorship practices where you take credit for something that someone else really did most of the work on, or where you list an honorific author in the hopes that their prestige will get you published, or when you are careless, such as sloppy record keeping, or when you intentionally rig your samples or your methods so that you bias the results, when you don't adequately supervise your research assistant so that some mistakes are made and never detected and inappropriate data gets incorporated in the analyses.
Mm-hmm. So so this is bad and nobody likes it, but is there really a problem? I mean, what happens if this stuff gets into the literature? It's wrong, but so what?
Well, people will continue to rely on it and cite it. And as I'm sure you and others know, there have been some rather sensational cases in the biomedical area where people's medical treatment was modified based on research which was inaccurate. And sometimes because the studies that are required are expensive to conduct or lengthy to carry out, they're unlikely to be replicated. And so it may be a while or never before some of these errors get picked up.
So is there a particular study that you're thinking about that comes to mind where somebody's medical treatment or some pattern of medical treatment was actually based on misunderstood or misrepresented data?
Well, there were two types of studies in particular. One was a cardiology study where people were enrolled who really didn't fit the criteria of what was supposed to be the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some people in the sample who shouldn't have been there and biased the treatment outcome results. There was also at least one cancer chemotherapy study which suggested that women who had breast cancer needed higher levels or longer durations of tamoxifen treatment than was actually necessary.
Yeah, and I'm recalling there was also that one in bone marrow transplants for women with breast cancer that was based on one study that was found to have errors in it.
Correct.
So, yes, I guess it happens. Well, we have people interested in talking about this, so let's take a call now and go to Paul in Wichita, Kansas. Paul, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm currently studying a doctoral degree in finance, it's not science related, I suppose, but we also come across the same set of problems. And I'm wondering if the speaker could talk about, do they see the problem as being more of a moral issue that they just want to try to get published, or is it more of something that they're just sloppy?
Okay, Paul,
because
thanks.
We do the same thing.
Yeah, thanks for that call. Dr. Kuchar, what do you think?
All varieties. Certainly there are some people who are clueless about the fact that they're doing the wrong statistical analysis or that someone's been careless. But there are also people who deliberately cheat. They rationalize away their scientific principles, or because of some potential gain or pressure on them, they compromise them. And also they think that they're going to get away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what do you see as you're proposing a solution here, or at least part of a solution? What do you see as what is that?
Well, my three colleagues who worked on this project together named the project colleagues as a defense against bad science, and our goal was to mobilize our colleagues to speak out when they see something happening, because your lab buddy or your partner down the hall or someone at your institution may notice something that they could call out to you. And we actually published a guide called Responding to Research Wrongdoing, which is distributed free over our website, ethicsresearch.com.
Right. But I looked at that, and here's the question. I mean, I worked in a lab myself once upon a time, and it would take a lot of nerve for me as a lab technician to go up to the head of the lab and say, I think you're doing something wrong. Does that happen? Are people willing to do that?
It does happen. You've hit the nail on the head, though. It is far easier to speak out about someone who is lower on you than on the totem pole. If you, in working as a student or a postdoc in the lab, were to notice something that your boss was doing, it would be much harder to speak out. So one of the things we suggest are some gentle alternatives, ways to approach and raise the issue without being intimidating.
Right.
And yes, there are some people who will be nasty and who will be obnoxious about it, but if you use some of these gentle alternatives, you may at least chasten the person and get them to think twice.
Right. So you lying cheat is probably not your opening line.
Exactly correct.
Okay. Let's take another call now and go to Flora in Glen Burnie. I guess that's Glen Burnie, Maryland?
Yes, it's Laura from Glen Burnie, Maryland.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Very interesting show. My question, I was told to keep it brief, but peer review, we have allowed, the medical and scientific community to police itself. And if there's a problem with this, and of course there have been famous cases of, people claiming that they did things and turned out it was wrong, but eventually it got revealed.
Okay, well, let me ask Dr. Kuchar, what about peer review? Do you think that peer review is going to catch these things or not? What is peer review? Maybe you can review that.
Well, peer review refers to the idea when you want to publish your research, it is sent by the journal editor or the publication editor out to experts who take a look at it, most of the time not knowing who wrote it, and comment and review it for scientific rigor. And that will pick up many problems, in particular carelessness or sometimes poor statistical analyses. However, the peer review will not be able to detect something that went wrong before the manuscript was written and sent in.
I see. And so these things, as I said, they're not always, it's not always obvious that something has been tinkered with. It could just be hidden, and it could take a long time before somebody discovers it.
That's right. And in some fields, particularly biomedical research, you may have tissue samples or other hard things that you can go look at. In behavioral science, mostly we might have interview data or questionnaire data, and the person who filled it out is long gone by the time the publication results.
Right. So how are you going to know if this approach, this gentle persuasion on the part of lab members, is working?
Well, there are a number of ways. One is if you see some direct effect of it. We, based on the survey we did, however, a substantial number of people were able to correct the problem with informal means. So based on these anecdotes, we think that there's a high likelihood of being effective. At least 30 to 40% of the interventions seem to be effective.
But these are, again, you're looking at what people have been telling you. You haven't actually been able to go and observe this, or you have to rely on people's reports.
No, that's right. We are relying on people's responses to an anonymous survey.
Right.
The people we surveyed were very senior. They were all people who were principal investigators on federally funded grants. So they weren't research novices.
Right. And the government has this Office of Research Integrity, I think it's called now. How have they responded to this?
Well, ORI were actually one of the agencies that gave us the grant to do the study, and we're grateful to them and the National Institute of Neurological Diseases and Stroke who funded us. But ORI necessarily only focuses on the recipients of federal funds, and they're really only concerned with the FF&P, the fabrication, falsification, and plagiarism. So they don't concern themselves with what, according to our data, are some other very significant potential problems.
So, I mean, just one quick example of something that's not FFP, but that's a big problem still.
Well, for example, carelessness. You have sloppy record keeping,
right,
or one of your research assistants isn't running the rats at night when they told you they were doing it.
Okay.
And
right,
you're not monitoring them.
All right. I get the picture. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Kuchar, thank you very much. An interesting topic.
Thank you, Joe.
That was Dr. Jerry Kuchar. He's a professor of psychology and associate provost of Simmons College in Boston. You can find out more about his work at their website, researchethics.com. When we come back, we'll be talking about silk. So stay with us.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Michelle Norris, and we began this hour with a sign of weakness in the economic recovery. The government reported today that the economy grew more slowly in the second quarter of this year than it did in the first. But in Michigan today, President Obama offered a spirited defense of his recovery program, especially the decision to bail out the domestic auto industry. Touring a pair of auto factories, the president said his controversial rescue of Chrysler and General Motors is beginning to pay off. As NPR Scott Horsley reports, the U.S. auto industry has added some 55,000 jobs since the two companies emerged from bankruptcy last year.
Today's auto tour was a kind of victory lap for President Obama. He told workers at the Jefferson North Assembly Plant in Detroit he's always had a soft spot for Chrysler.
The first new car that I ever bought was a Grand Cherokee.
Even as he fondly recalled that new car's smell, though, Mr. Obama said his Cherokee was no match for the 2011 model now in production at this plant. Chrysler just added a second shift here, hiring 1,100 additional workers. Standing in front of an unpainted Cherokee frame, Mr. Obama said those workers are proving wrong the naysayers who argued against his rescue of Chrysler and GM.
I wish they were standing here today. I wish they could see what I'm seeing in this plant and talk to the workers who are here taking pride in building a world-class vehicle. I don't think they'd be willing to look you in the eye and say that you were a bad investment.
One of those grateful workers is Daryl Ezell, whose job is installing doors on the new Cherokee. He's worked at Chrysler for about 15 years, but says his job would have been in jeopardy without the government's help.
Nothing like presidential leadership to step in and handle a very contentious situation that was the situation here in Detroit. I appreciate it. I mean, I owe my job to him, basically. We all owe our job to him.
Automakers' renewed hiring has barely put a dent in Michigan's unemployment rate, which still tops 13%. But Ron Blum, who helped lead the Treasury Department's auto task force, says without the Chrysler and GM rescues, at least 1 million more jobs would have been lost. And not just at those two companies.
This is an incredibly interdependent industry. And if GM had failed, a very large number of suppliers would have immediately failed. And that would have had a cascading effect through the balance of the industry, Ford included, and potentially others as well.
Instead, Blum says carmakers are slowly recovering. General Motors is expected to hold a public stock offering later this year. That could allow the government to recover most of its GM investment.
While there is still a long way to go, the companies are also showing positive signs of financial performance. In the first quarter, all of them made operating profits. So we think there's a lot of signs that while slow, the industry is truly coming back.
Mr. Obama also toured a General Motors plant where the Chevy Volt will be manufactured, and he took one of the plug-in hybrids for a spin. 9 GM factories were busy enough to work through their usual summer shutdowns this year, and Chrysler announced during the president's visit its plant in Sterling Heights, Michigan, will not close in 2012 as scheduled, but will instead stay open and hire additional workers next year. All of this leaves workers like Ezel feeling a little more optimistic.
Morale is very high now compared to what it was this time last year. It was kind of bleak, but got a good positive product. That's the main thing. Hopefully we can get some more shifts going on in here and return to prosperity and profitability.
And if they keep our wages, we might buy one too.
Ezel's co-worker, Katrina Brown Johnson, makes a good point. On the day the Commerce Department reported weaker than expected consumer spending, Americans' confidence in their own fortunes will determine the cars and other products they buy and their judgment on the steps President Obama has taken to steer the economy. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Detroit.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. If you're the poet laureate of the state of Montana, you could carry out your duties several ways. You could spend a lot of time talking to school children or promote poetry through the local libraries, perhaps talk to civic organizations. Well, Henry Reelbird decided to get on horseback at one end of the state and ride halfway to the other, handing out books of poetry along the way. And we caught up with Mr. Reelbird as he's been doing just that. Exactly where are you right now?
I'm in Havre, Montana, along the Milk River. Tomorrow I saddle up and I drift off into the Bear Paw Mountains, and I end up over in Rocky Boy, Montana, my final destination.
Who are you traveling with?
I'm riding with my Hidatsa brother, Levi Bruce, from Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. As a Crow Indian, I'm a Hidatsa. Hidatsa and Crow were one tribe, and so our language is still, the grammar is still the same, and it's still pretty close. Like, he says, Billy for water, and I say, Bila.
Can you do me a favor? We always hear about those big skies of Montana. What's that sky look like today?
It's so big that you can't really put an edge to it. That's how it is today, in a vast sea of buffalo grass.
Henry Reelbird, tell me about the books that you're handing out and the reception that you get.
Oh, the books that I'm handing out are my books of poetry. I surprised some people, like at a cafe in Nashua, a guy that he had two boys there, young boys, high school boys. I mean, just so much promise and so much future. And then I just gave them the books so they can read that poetry. That plus, once I give them out and other people, they see me coming out a horseback and they walk over and they say, where's my book? And so I just hand them the book from atop the horse and everything. And so I just want them to think, to move along in thought.
To move along in thought. That sounds wonderful. Now, yeah. When they open up the pages of that book, could you just give us a small sample of what they would find? Would you mind reciting just a small bit of your poetry?
A little bit of it, okay. Sunrise whirls. Recapitulation of sunrise whirls. Thoughts of man. Civilization recedes. Waves on shore of sand. Attached to a reality now touches in lifespan. Matched links mark. Beginning of end strands. Scratch thoughts drawn on rock of cave. Preserve our humble beginning recorded in computer reserve. We question, wonder, learn, origin, and beyond. Shifting winds up the canyon walls, no barrier, we yawn. From the constant vigil of progress that marches toward both ends of the spectrum, cloning to nuclear arches, we give life and take life like them.
Mm. You say we question, wonder, and learn. I wonder what you're learning as you travel across the state and travel across some of the parts of the state where your ancestors lived.
Yeah, I can see life itself out here in Montana on the trail of the buffalo that now goes between elevators going to Cirrhosis Park. And all of the drinking that is on the Indian reservation that I don't want to see, but I do because that is life. And yet I wait for coffee at the convenience store at Fort Belknap, and all of the workers, and they're going to work for the day. And so to be able to see the young families full of promise and hope, and then to go along and to pick up words like Fur Cap Mountain. That's the Indian word for the Little Rocky Mountains. To be given all these things. I mean, people come by and they feed me dry meat, bannock bread. They crush choke cherries and give them to me. It's a beautiful place when people come and they hug you and they bless you to continue on and asking for a safe journey.
Well, safe journeys to you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. All the best.
Okay, may you ride in beauty, too, covered with love for many winters to come. Aho, we'll see you.
That's Henry Realbird, cowboy, member of the Crow Nation, and poet laureate of the state of Montana. Now, a new kind of medical technology that can transmit your physiological information to your doctor from just about anywhere. Think of it as a really smart Band-Aid. There's just one problem. It's so new that regulators are still figuring out what rules are necessary to protect the public. Colorado Public Radio's Eric Whitney reports.
A wirelessly enabled Band-Aid that can call your doctor when it detects a problem is still a very cutting-edge technology. But it builds on more than a decade of refining the practice of remote monitoring. That's when healthcare providers give patients simple-to-use home diagnostic equipment that connects to a network.
Hook it up.
Like the smart blood pressure cuff Natalie Cole uses in Golden, Colorado.
Hit the start button, and it'll run through its cycle. It's all automatic. I don't have to do anything but sit here.
The cuff inflates, takes a reading, and then, through her home computer, uploads the numbers to a secure website.
See if I remember my password on it.
The important part is that Cole can quickly and easily share her blood pressure numbers with doctors and pharmacists. The system has already helped them adjust her medication.
Because it wasn't quite where they wanted it. So they changed my prescription at that point.
Stories like that have convinced Cole's HMO, Kaiser Permanente Colorado, that networking smart medical devices in the home can improve care and save money. The Department of Veterans Affairs has been saying that for years. A recent VA study of 17,000 patients found remote monitoring cut hospitalizations by 19%. And remote monitoring is poised to become a lot more common thanks to a new generation of tiny sensors that can be worn by a patient 24/7, worn on an adhesive strip that sticks to the skin about the size of a large Band-Aid.
Band-Aids now, we know, can measure the electrocardiogram, the heart rhythm, respiratory rate, the temperature of the patient.
That's Dr. Eric Topol with the West Wireless Institute, an industry group that promotes wireless medical devices. He says smart Band-Aids can measure dozens of health indicators and then display readings on a patient's mobile phone or even the internet.
It's basically what we would call the body area network, where it involves a sensor, and today usually Bluetooth to get that to a transmitter and then sent off to the web.
Getting the information on the web enables all kinds of potential applications. One that's in the works is aimed at the problem physicians call noncompliance, better known as, "Mom, did you take your pills?" Dr. George Savage's startup company is developing tiny microchips that can be embedded in pills.
What we've managed to do is create a tiny grain of sand-sized integrated circuit, which is coated with essential minerals. And when swallowed, those different minerals generate a small amount of power, a little voltage.
That voltage can be detected on the skin by, you guessed it, a smart Band-Aid. It could literally text Savage, confirming his mother actually swallowed her pills. That kind of technology scares some people, and there's concern that it's all getting ahead of public safety. Federal regulators are still wrestling with who's responsible for approving the new generation of mobile health devices.
There is a little bit of a gray area, and that's part of the reason why we're stepping up our collaboration.
Julius Knapp is with the Federal Communications Commission. It's collaborating with the Food and Drug Administration to write new rules for the wireless medical industry. That's slowing the release of some products for which there's already demand. But Knapp says that delay is okay.
Where we need to make sure that there is reliable operation is where we may, for example, be monitoring critical life-sustaining functions or perhaps even controlling remotely treatment.
An example would be a wirelessly controlled insulin pump for diabetics. It could release exactly the right amount of insulin to keep someone healthy, based on readings sent to it by a smart Band-Aid. But if there's radio interference or some other glitch with either the patch or the pump, there could be serious health consequences. Knapp says the agencies want to open the door to the promise of the new technology, but only if it doesn't jeopardize people's lives. For NPR News, I'm Eric Whitney in Denver.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
In his sixth feature film, Life During Wartime, writer and director Todd Solondz returns to the New Jersey family of his third film, Happiness. The three sisters and their mother have left suburban New Jersey for Florida and California, where their lives seem even more untethered. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Todd Solondz is a skinny guy with a shock of hair and a droning voice that's oddly passionate. He writes deadpan comedies, the bleakest I've seen. His new film, Life During Wartime, is positively grueling. For better and worse, you'll never experience anything like this movie. It's a sequel to Solondz's 1998 film, Happiness, despite the fact that all the roles have been cast with different actors, who aren't much like their predecessors. The original focused on three disparate Jewish sisters living in New Jersey, one a mousy and miserable teacher, one the author of arty titillating short stories, and the third a chirpy housewife and mother. Happiness was a broad satire, with that ironic title hanging over it like a mushroom cloud. There were off-screen suicides, a murder, and a subplot about a psychiatrist, the husband of the housewife, who molests little boys. The tone of Life During Wartime fluctuates even more wildly, and I'm frankly still wrestling over its mix of humanism and grotesqueness, of stylized camp and acid realism. The feel is squirmy, malignant, close to David Lynch. It's largely set in Florida and L.A. and bears no traces of nature. In Edward Lachman's startling cinematography and Rochelle Berliner's production design, the world is artificially colored and overbaked. In Happiness, Jane Addams played the youngest of three warped sisters, Joy, and she was tremulous and sexy. But Joy is now the more damaged Shirley Henderson, who has a twittery child voice and a withered demeanor. Lara Flynn Boyle's sultry Helen is now Ally Sheedy, who's brittle and high-strung, hopelessly nihilistic, even in the lap of Hollywood luxury. Cynthia Stevenson's Trish has been elongated into Allison Janney, who seems even more encased in her bubble of obliviousness. Over an al fresco lunch, Trish tells Joy she's getting married again.
But don't you think you're maybe rushing things a bit? I mean, men are, I don't know. And after Bill.
Bill was totally different.
Still.
No. The past is the past. Dead, gone, wiped my hands, forgot. It's got nothing to do with me and the kids. We live in Florida now.
I'm sorry.
Just. Now, Harvey, on the other hand, well, he's not very attractive. He's older. He's not even that well off. He's divorced. Poor thing had a horrible, horrible wife. But he's Jewish. He's pro-Israel. He did vote for Bush and McCain, but only because of Israel. He knows these people are complete idiots otherwise, so don't worry. Basically, he's just a plain, totally family-oriented kind of guy. He's a real mensch.
The Israel reference is purposeful. Stars of David, Israeli flags, images of battle in Gaza show up in the background and on TV screens. They're not belabored, only glimpsed. But this is the wartime of Solondz's title, borrowed from a Talking Heads song, but given new meaning. Unacknowledged by these sisters is a world of bloodshed and tribal allegiances. In Life During Wartime, there are no male figures with power or stature. But Paul Rubens is shockingly vivid as the ghost of Joy's ex-boyfriend, who committed suicide over her and now reappears, either to plead for her affection or abuse her. Kieran Hines plays Trish's ex-husband, the pedophile, newly released from prison, who's making his way to see his estranged college-age son. In the last half hour, Solondz's focus shifts from the adults to Trish's two young children, freckle-faced Dylan Riley Snyder and Emma Hines. They're the ones who notice the war on TV, the sterility of their environment, the void in the grown-ups' lives, and they weep over the loss of moral authority. Though they're wildly different, there's a thematic connection between life during wartime and Steven Spielberg's Munich, with its protagonist who begs at the end for someone to restore his link to the world of the ancestors, because this world is rotting from within. The children's weeping is the one thread of hope, faint but insistent, in this all-enveloping bad dream, the feel-bad movie of the year. I didn't enjoy this movie. I mean, how can you? But my own faith is rekindled by Todd Solondz, who's found a form for the chaotic, contradictory impulses that we live with during wartime.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. There are several scenes from Life During Wartime at our website, freshair.npr.org.